Hi, everyone. This is Liam Deckel with the Student Screening Podcast. Today, we're here with writer, producer, professor, and the creator and director of the undergraduate screenwriting program at the University of Michigan, Jim Bernstein. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Liam. How are you?
I'm good. You?
Doing well. Getting ready for another academic year to start.
You're lucky. I already started 2 weeks ago. Yeah. So thank you for coming on the show today. Before we start, could you tell us a bit about your screenwriting background? You know, like what have you written?
Sure. Actually, the very first feature-length screenplay I ever wrote was Renaissance Man. I was lucky enough to eventually sell it and get it made. Penny Marshall directed it, came out in 1994. Starred Danny DeVito, Gregory Hines. It was Mark Wahlberg's first movie. And that was a pretty good run on your first film.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And then I was I had a contract with Disney to because they it was a Touchstone film, and that's where Renaissance Man was. And so I had a another screenplay that I promised to write him, but I didn't know what. That turned out to be D3, The Mighty Ducks. Yeah. Which got made right away. And it was as that was wrapping up that I got asked to return to my alma mater, the University of Michigan, where I agreed to teach one course. And I've been, you know, eventually built that into a program, but I've continued with my writing career, though I had to find a collaborator to help me during those two times a year when I'm grading screenplays. So
yeah,
I have a writing partner in LA, Garrett Schiff, and we've done, we've sold scripts to every studio. We've had the movies Ruffian made for ESPN and ABC starring Sam Shepard. We had Naughty or Nice for ABC with George Lopez. And we have Love and Honor with Liam Hemsworth and Teresa Palmer that we did as an independent film with IFC.
Yeah, that's very cool. Yep. So why don't we dive into the beginning? At what age did you get into screenwriting and what made you do so?
Well, it was on my way to law school, actually. I was 21, had just graduated from the University of Michigan. I actually got married a month after I graduated, which is hard to believe now that people had actually did that kind of thing. But we were driving to Madison from Ann Arbor. It's a long drive. And on the way, I realized I wanted to be a lawyer when I was 10 years old, but I didn't want to be a lawyer now. And I thought, and I had done some creative writing at Michigan and some playwriting. And I recalled something my favorite professor said as a throwaway line one day in class, Complete Works of Shakespeare class. He said, if Shakespeare were alive today, he would be a screenwriter. And I didn't know what that was. I'd never read a screenplay. And so, you know, my head started to spin like The Exorcist. And I thought while I'm driving to Madison, I'm thinking to myself, that sounds cool. You know, I want to be a screenwriter. I don't know what they do, but, you know, that sounds cool. It didn't occur to me that somebody wrote movies. So that was one thing. The other thing I thought about was I want to teach Shakespeare to people who would never have it except for me. Yeah. And I didn't see those two things as related. I thought Shakespeare is the greatest stuff in the world, so everybody should be entitled to it. And certainly people like me who go to the University of Michigan should take it on their own. They don't need me. And so those are my two goals. I walked into law school and I was walking out as I was walking in.
Yeah.
You know, the dean asked, I went to the dean and said, I was the youngest member of the class. I said, sorry, I made a horrible mistake. And he said, oh, everybody thinks that their first term. You're not the first to come see me. And I said, yeah, but I mean it. He said, well, I'll tell you what, we'll give you 5 years to finish. And if you don't, you know, just stay the first semester. If you don't like it, you can take a year and a half off. Mm-hmm. And I said to him, you know, it's really hard to get in here. Why are you making it harder to get out? And I stayed the semester, and then I left, came back to Ann Arbor. I was a little afraid, got my master's in English. I toyed with being a PhD in English for about 5 minutes, got my master's in English Lit, which would allow me to teach. I didn't even do it for that reason. And then I just went out and decided I'm going to be a writer and look for places to teach Shakespeare. Mm. I did a lot of freelance advertising, a lot of radio, television, print commercials. I did freelance journalism, magazine articles, newspaper stuff. Anybody who'd pay me to write so I could buy my writing time. And I started knocking on doors of like community centers, senior citizen places, to see if I could teach Shakespeare for free.
Yeah.
And they said no. They said, can you do aerobics? And I said no. They said, can you do macrame? And I said no, Shakespeare. And they said no. And then I had a friend call me who was an admissions counselor at Wayne State University and said, you still looking to teach Shakespeare? And I said, yeah. He said, they're looking for an English teacher out at Selfridge Air National Guard Base. That's one of the only two bases in the world where every branch of the American military is housed. And I had no idea what any of that was because I had no experience with the military other than protesting the Vietnam War. Mm-hmm. So, when he said they were looking for an English teacher, I said, what, soldiers? Wow, that's exactly who I was looking for. I just didn't know it.
Yeah.
So I went out there and, you know, I called and they said no. So I told them I was going to teach English composition the way I learned it from the same professor who I had in my senior year. I had my freshman year, Russell Fraser, one of the great Shakespearean scholars on the planet. He's deceased since, but he would have us learn how to write an essay by reading Shakespeare plays. And that's what I wanted to teach them. And they said no. And then I called back and I said, no, really, it'll work. Trust me on this. And they said no. And then I called back again. I'm talking to the head of the Army Education Office. And finally he said, if you promise never to call me again, I'll let you do it. So I did. And that's actually where Renaissance Man came from. It came straight from my teaching Shakespeare to soldiers. So, you know, they say, write what you know. But I had done some, before that, I had started by writing some TV movies. At that time, late 70s, TV movies were all the rage in America. And I watched them and figured, well, any fool can do that, so I qualify. And then I wrote one and realized it was harder than I thought. I knew one person who knew somebody in Los Angeles, and it was a cousin of mine who was friends with Ed Asner, who played Lou Grant on the Murray Tyler Moore Show. So I could get stuff to him, and he had this new show called a spinoff character off the Murray Tyler Moore Show called the Lou Grant Show. It was a serious show about journalism. Mm-hmm. And I sent treatment that he liked, and I wasn't in the Writers Guild and the producers didn't want me, but they said they'd help me if I came out there and, you know, make Ed happy by saying they were helping me. And so I went out, and then they're the ones who told me, you know, no, you're not going to get hired to write a TV job being out there. Write something shows you can write. So that's where I got the idea to write a TV movie. I wrote the first one for Ed. He thought it was pretty bad, so I wrote it again. And then he liked it enough to send me to an agent. That didn't get me anything. I wrote another one. It wasn't very good, although I tried hard. I wrote a third one. I was writing fast now. I wrote a third one about a friend of mine who was, sorry about my dog there.
It's okay.
And this one I knew was going to do something.
Yeah.
It was about a guy I grew up with in Detroit who dropped out of University of Michigan after 2 years to go to Ringling Brothers Barnum and Bailey Clown College. So, he said I could go to Michigan for another, I could go to Ringling for 6 weeks and become a clown, or I could finish up at Michigan after 2 years and become a clown. So he decided to drop out. Imagine how happy his parents were. But he learned all, he didn't join Ringling after he got his degree. He joined this European circus, Circus Bartok, and traveled up and down the East Coast of America, learned the European art of clowning with the great, I believe, Swiss clown Grock, if you're familiar with him. If not, look him up. And he wanted to be like him. You know, he was really a music hall, you know, performer, could play a million instruments. And, you know, funny, you know, it was a whole performance, sing, the whole shot. And so he tried to start an act like that in America. It was going nowhere. He was also a novelist. His novels weren't being, he couldn't get anything published. And so to get away from himself, he volunteered at this, he looked in the yellow pages and volunteered at this school, not realizing it was a school for autistic children, because back then you weren't awake about autism in America. And he volunteered to work with this one kid that nobody wanted to work with, because this kid wasn't Rain Man. This kid had never spoken a word. He was violent. He banged his head against the wall. He bit himself until he bled. He was like 6 years old, and he was, you know, he was a wild child. Mm-hmm. And my friend was in such a bad place, especially after his dog got run over and killed and his girlfriend broke up with him, that he, I mean, he was in a bad place. So what he did was he just did what people like him do, performers. He just started mimicking what the kid was doing, only he really did it. If the kid bit his arm till he bled, he did that. If the kid banged his head against the wall, he did it. And then one day, he was taking a breath. He was sitting on the floor with his hands folded, and he looked up and noticed the kid named Adam was mimicking him. And then he reversed the game. And he taught the kid say his first words.
Wow.
And the people in the school were amazed. But what I noticed was, is that at his encounters with Adam had changed his clown act, Buffon, as he became like a hybrid of himself, who was this Buffon the clown, and this kid. His personality infected it. And so audience started to love it. Performers who came to Detroit to see him, like Steve Martin, Pat Paulson, and Odetta, the folk singer, they all were falling in love with his act. And so he had eventually, and he was playing colleges across the country, but he had to make a decision. Was he going to take the job offered him by the school? The head of the school was going to write a book about what he was doing and why, trying to figure out why it worked, or was he going to move to LA and seek his fortune? Well, he moved to LA.
Yeah.
And I wrote that TV movie, and it flew through the system. I went from not being able, it was called Learn to Fall. I went from not being able to get an agent to having three.
Wow, okay.
And you know, I was young and dumb. So I took the youngest of them, because I don't want to go through this again.
Yeah. You know,
that's not the smartest way to take an agent. But you know, he did a good job at first, and screenplay flew through Hollywood. Wow. I mean, famous producer Ray Stark, his company, optioned it. He had done movies like Funny Girl. And then CBS Television, one of the three major networks, they wanted it. Timothy Hutton was set to star in it right after Ordinary People. And I thought to myself, I've been doing this less than 2 years. I thought Hollywood was hard. It's not that hard. I was in Variety, The Hollywood Reporter. And then I realized I was wrong. 2 weeks, and Buzz Kulik, the guy who directed Brian Song, which was like the most famous American TV movie ever.
Wow, okay.
Directing 2 weeks before principal photography, we were done pretty much with pre-production. I'd finished the last, you know, draft of it. Yeah. Timothy got a new agent. She pulled him out of it. CBS went crazy. And although, you know, the option was renewed, they eventually just pulled the plug on it. And I went from, wow, what happened? And that's how I came to write my first feature.
Yeah.
Because my mentor, a man named Kurt Ludtke, who passed away a year ago this month, had been executive editor of Detroit Free Press, most important, one of two big newspapers in the state of Michigan. And he'd won a Pulitzer Prize, I think. I mean, he was just brilliant.
Yeah.
At 37, he decided that he'd already had the best job in journalism he was ever going to have, so he should do something else. So he thought he should become a producer. And he went to Hollywood, and they said, we don't need you to produce. Tell us a story. He told them a story, and they said, okay, now you're going to write that. And he wound up writing Absence of Malice, that starred Paul Newman and Sally Field, and he's nominated for an Academy Award for his first screenplay. And it was while I was writing Learn to Fall, he was writing Absence of Malice. We were introduced by a mutual friend of ours, and, you know, things were going great. Well, they turned out they were going great for him. And after Learn to Fall fell, we were at a party, and he said to me, and I'll never forget this, he said, as long as you're not going to get paid, why don't you not get paid more? And I was so drunk, I understood what he said. Yeah. And then, stop screwing around with TV movies, write for the big screen. And he said, have you ever thought about writing a movie about your experience teaching Shakespeare to soldiers? I said, yeah, I thought about it. He said, well, come up with a, you know, an idea of how you do that. And if I like it, you know, I'll option it, not, you know, I'll pay you something to write it. And I said, no, I don't want your charity. We're friends. And he said, well, you're an idiot. Think about it. So I went home, you know, had a wife and baby now. And I looked at the next morning, the roof is leaking and I need a new roof. And I call him up and I said, you know, maybe I've been a little drinking too much last night. I think I will. So he's the one who taught me the difference between writing a TV movie, which is very, very, you know, you're writing to every commercial, as opposed to writing a feature film. It's the difference between high school basketball and the NBA, the speed at which it moves.
Yeah.
And he also taught me the most important thing, which is don't, you know, your first draft's gonna suck, and mine certainly did. And he had, you know, he taught me the tools. Really the steps of the dance. I mean, I knew how to write a treatment, but I didn't know how to write a step outline. And that's a scene by scene breakdown in each act. And that's the tool with which, you know, feature has so many moving parts. You want one of those. And then it taught me, you know, my first drafts suck, rewrite it. I rewrote it. He told me, you clearly don't know how to rewrite. And then he blew it up. And then he showed me how to write a third draft. So I wrote the third draft and he said, you know, okay, this isn't all bad. Now I've had a lot of people tell me they love my screenplays. That's the best compliment I ever had. he thought everything sucked, including his own work. So it wasn't all bad. So I wrote a fourth draft and he said, I think we've gone as far as your talent will carry us. And so let's get it out there. And so I did. And my agent, who had done nothing for me after Learn to Fall, he did one great thing. As he decided he wasn't a great agent, he was going to go work in development for Ronnie Howard at Imagine. He left my draft of Renaissance Man, which was really my fourth draft, but nobody knew that. You don't put it on it. You just say, hey, here it is. I'm a genius. And put it on his boss's desk. And the boss calls me, a man named Stu Robinson, head of a writer's agency called Robinson, Weintraub, and Gross. He called me and said, I don't know who you are or where you live. Is it Chicago? And I said, well, that's close enough. It's only 4 hours away, so what the hell? And he said, I read your script. There's not an ounce of fat on it. From now on, I'm going to represent you. It might take me 2 years, but I guarantee you I'll sell this. Yeah. Well, he didn't know who I was, but I knew who he was. He's the guy who sold E.T. He represented John Sayles.
Wow.
So I'm on the phone. I'm on the next plane going out there to meet him. And I go out there and he says to me, he takes me to lunch and he says, so what do you want to do? You want to stay in Michigan and swing for the fences, or do you want to move out here and I'll set you up with a lot of meetings and pitches and all that stuff? And I looked at him and I thought to myself, do I lie or do I tell the truth? Well, he looked a lot like my dad, so I had to tell the truth. And my wife had a good teaching job in Michigan. I had a house. I could not possibly afford my life in Los Angeles. And I said, I got to stay in Michigan, swing for the fences. And he said, well, I don't care. I represent John Sayles. He doesn't live here. But if I tell you to get on a plane for a meeting, you're going to get out here. I said, oh, yeah, it's a lot cheaper. Done. And so that was it. It took nearly 2 years to the day. But, he got it set up at Fox. And before that, people liked it enough, right before that, where I was hired by Columbia Pictures, which is now Sony, to do an adaptation of a book for Michael Douglas's company. So that got me in the Writers Guild. And then Stu called me up and said, this producer, Sarah Colleton, has read your script, wants to meet with you, get on a plane. I flew out there, met with her. She said, are you willing to make some changes? And I said, I thought to myself, here it comes. There goes Shakespeare. It's going to be Neil Simon for soldiers. And so I said, yeah. And she said, this script is really about teaching Shakespeare, isn't it? And I said, yeah. And she said, this love story you have in there, you tack that on for commercial purposes, didn't you? And I said, okay, yeah, I'll cop to that. And then she said, great. If you're willing to make some changes, I think we can make a deal. By the time I flew home, the deal was done. Now I'm flying back. And now she tells me, I've written a wonderful little screenplay. She's going to teach me how to write a great big movie. And basically, we were going to, she loved it, but we were going to make it bigger by I had written it. I picked one service, which was the Air Force. She said, no, we're going to shift to the Army. And rather than your experience where the guys are older than you, I want you to go with the ones who are younger than you, because I had some of them. And I want it to take place during basic training, because then we're combining, the teacher movie with the basic training movie, and that might have a chance. And so I said, okay. She said, I want you to go back to the hotel tonight and, tell me who the students are going to be. I know who the teacher is. So tell me who the students in the class are going to be. So her assistant took me to a lovely dinner. She was the one who brought it to her, the assistant. A young woman named Elizabeth Schwartz, who had seen it at another company and loved it and bought it when she went to work for Sarah. That's how this business works. You got to get people to really love your scripts enough to pass them along. And I went back to the hotel and I wrote up characters. Came in the next morning. I told her a lot more characters than turned out to be in the movie, because the movie can only have so many characters. But yeah. I gave her the whole pass. And she said, when did you do that? And I said, well, last night at the hotel after dinner, you told me to do that, right? And she says, yeah, but nobody ever does that, really. And I said, but I'm from Michigan. I don't know. I'm too dumb. She said, then she loved me because I would do the, I would do the work.
Yeah.
And so basically, yeah, the lesson here is I had to start over.
Yeah.
And draft five, I had a 2-draft deal at Fox, was no better than draft 4. In fact, it was worse. 6 was about as good. They didn't want to do it. And then they had a 1.5-year option on their deal. And Sarah said, be patient. It'll be up soon. And she optioned it, took it to Touchstone. They liked it, took forever to make a deal. They wanted to rewrite. That's 7 drafts. And then they sent out to directors. The first one was Penny Marshall. She wanted a rewrite. Each rewrite gets a little less now. That's 8. That's 8 drafts, 10 years, my first feature in a movie. So that's the end of that
story. Yeah. So you just said so much. So I have some small little questions to ask you that you've kind of covered. You already talked about. Yep. Yeah. So I see that you studied English at the University of Michigan. Do you think that really helped with your career, or do you think it helped more with your teaching career?
Absolutely. I can't tell you how much I've used Shakespeare.
Yeah.
In my career. Mm-hmm. So the screenplay called Naked Shakespeare. I have a graphic novel / comic book, my writing partner and I, coming out either late this year or beginning of next year for Dark Horse Comics, called Hamlet. It's a children's thing about it's a comic version of Hamlet and all the tragedies.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It also taught me, what great writing is, making every word count. Yeah. Taught me about story, right? Mm-hmm. Being an English major, when my son was a student at the University of Michigan, he majored in my department, did really well, but I made him be an English major too. Now that we're much more developed, my younger son went through our department. I didn't make that same demand, but he took a lot of English courses too. I made him take Shakespeare, that's for sure.
Yeah.
It's like the poet John Keats said, after Shakespeare, there's nothing more to be said about anything.
Wow.
But hey, basically we got to make a living, so let's write. I mean, it's incredible. He covered the map. So I don't think there's a better education for writers than reading all of Shakespeare's plays. So
yeah.
There you go. But yes, so I do think it is. Yeah. I do think our program is exceptionally good at teaching screenwriting. Mm-hmm. The people in our program, all have credits, are all really good writers, and
So one thing I found really
writers.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I see.
Yeah. So one thing I found really cool about you is that you broke into Hollywood while still living in Plymouth, Michigan. You already went over this, but just to make sure,
yeah,
you did this. You got your work seen by networking, and you had a friend in LA who helped you.
No, when you say networking, I had a cousin in LA who was a lawyer, who was, I guess he might have done legal work for Ed, but they were friends. Mm-hmm. For Ed Asner, that's one person.
Yeah.
I knew somebody who knew one person in show business. That's it. Well, yes, networking is great. But if you don't have anything to show, it's not worth anything. That's what I teach my students. Yeah. Great, network, but make sure you got something really good to show. We teach rewriting. I mean, you know, what made our program different is we were the first undergraduate program who once, you know, I taught a screen. Go ahead.
Because you say that networking isn't as important, what advice do you have for young screenwriters who don't live in places with a large film industry who want to succeed in film?
Yeah, my advice is don't send out screenplays like they're lottery tickets. Don't send out first drafts hoping they're good.
Yeah.
Rewrite them. Send them to people who you can trust, who might know something to give you some advice on what needs, what's working, what's not working. Rewrite them. And then there are lots of places you can go. There are a lot of contests now that you can enter. There are the big ones like the NICL, Academy in LA ones, Academy of Motion Pictures, Art and Sciences. If you're a finalist in that, people are going to find you. There are a lot of great screenwriting contests now that didn't exist when I was there. Three of my students have won the Final Draft Big Break contest. One of my former students just won the Creative Screenwriting contest. You can put your screenplay on the blacklist and get people to evaluate it. And if you get an 8 or above, you're going to get contacted by managers. And so it's a different world now where you don't necessarily have to be in LA. You don't have to be in America to get noticed. Mm-hmm. Is it good to try to get to LA if you can and meet some people? Yeah, it's a good idea. I mean, virtually none of my students, including my youngest son, followed my example. They all moved to LA or New York, but you know, if you want to be a screenwriter, I think LA is the better bet because that's where the business is. But with TV and all the opportunities now, man, eventually you move, but there's, my advice is save your money, write, be the best writer you can, have things to show, and, you know, get it out there.
Yeah. So I'm going to ask you some craft questions now about screenwriting.
Okay. Yep.
So what do you tell a writer who has writer's block? What do you tell them to do?
Okay. Here's the thing. I'm not saying writer's block is a myth because I know it can happen.
Yeah.
I mean, I think my mentor, Kurt Lundke, actually, I don't know if it was writer. I mean, his second screenplay, he won the Academy Award for Out of Africa.
Wow.
I mean, this guy was great. But I think there were times, and I think, you know, when you're nominated on your first and you win on your second, I think you just feel the weight of expectation.
Yeah.
That's not a problem that most young writers have.
Yeah.
So here's my cure. It's what I teach my students. Write every day. You're better off writing an hour every day. Have a good step outline. Just run.
I'm sorry. Is a step outline the same as like a beat sheet?
Yeah, it's like a beat sheet, except you need to know where every scene is and when it takes place, and that there's some cause and effect that gets you, you know, to each act turn. And so you know you have some sort of map that's going to get you to the end, right?
Yeah.
And don't worry. Don't worry when you sit down if it's going to be good. Just write every single day. You're better off writing an hour or two a day than trying to write, you know, 10 hours or 12 hours on Saturday and Sunday or whatever. That's not how it goes. Writers write. They show up.
Yeah.
Professional writers tend to write in the morning. Get up in the morning, have a cup of coffee, don't screw around, sit down and write.
Yeah.
And don't worry about it being good or bad. Judd Apatow's first draft, he calls the vomit pass. Get through. That's what rewriting is about. Once you've got something down, you've defeated the blank piece of paper, right?
Yeah.
John Patrick Shanley, who won the Academy Award for Moonstruck and wrote Doubt and directed that, great playwright, great screenwriter, great director.
Yeah.
When he spoke to the students, he said, look, everybody's got 50,000 bad pages in them. Just get started. The second time he came in, I said, John, I got to tell you, I think it's closer to 100,000. I'm past the 50,000 mark. And it's true. You're going to write bad pages, but you have to trust the process. And when you go through it again and again, and you cut what's not working and you see what you need to make this story work, they're going to get better. But it's just, it's about showing up. It's like Michael Jordan, LeBron James aren't the best basketball players just on their talent alone. They might have more talent than anyone, but they also spend more time in the gym than anyone. They have dedicated themselves. You want a craft question. The craft question is showing up. Woody Allen had that part right. 99% of the job is showing up.
Yeah. Yeah. And then finally, for the last question, what's your best tip for screenwriters to improve their work?
Okay. Well, I've gone over this again and again. Understand, don't count on a first draft. Don't count on a second draft. Rewrite until you get to where you want.
Yeah.
But I would say the most important thing is understanding what your emotional connection is to what you're writing.
Yeah.
In other words, don't chase the market. Don't say, oh, this is what they're making today. Because by the time you're done, they're 5 years ahead of you.
Yeah.
What you're seeing today was written 3 to 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. So don't chase the market. What is it that you want to write and why? If you're just being cynical and saying, oh, I think this will sell, that's a fool's bet.
Yeah.
You wanna know, I Monday night will be my first class in my rewrite class. I will ask them to tell me a recurring dream or a dream they've had that they'll never forget.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll tell me. And then I'll ask the class, what do you think that's about? And then they'll go deep and say what they think the dream's about. I try to tell people a first draft is like a dream. You think you know what it's about, but until you really know what it's about, you don't know what the thematic underpinnings of your story are. Yeah. And it's connecting the thematic underpinnings, what issues you're exploring, what emotional journey, all these elements work together. Who's your protagonist? Whose story is it? What is their emotional journey? What is their arc? You have to know not just story, but what their issue is. Their issue or issues are the themes of the story. And that's why you have to, oftentimes people don't have the right protagonist. They think they know whose story it is, but they're wrong. It's there's a better one in that screenplay, And so it's connecting those things, and it's connecting the protagonist's pursuit of their goal to the subtext of the script, the theme that'll bubble up in the end. That's the thing. It's learning how the elements work.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I think you taught us a lot, especially me. I learned a lot today.
Great.
Thank you for coming, Jim. If anyone wants to know more about Jim and his films, check out his IMDb page. Thank you for listening to the Student Screenwriting Podcast.